first want to speak about states of consciousness and addiction. And I think, obviously, you don't need to be Carl Jung or nuclear physicist to know that states and addiction is very closely tied up. And I mean, the academics point that out as if it's a revelation, but I think every addict on the planet understands states very clearly, because that's ultimately what they're trying to do, is to change their consciousness from one state to another state.
Yeah, absolutely.
So on the surface, it's quite a simple concept, but there's quite a lot to this whole idea of states. And I think what a lot of people have been pointing out is that human beings have got a natural, nearly an innate need, and some go as far as to say that it's nearly a sort of neurologically hardwired in our physiology, a need for altered states of consciousness. And what these guys point out is that because we have such a profound need for alteration of consciousness, we're going to seek out ways to alter consciousness one way or another. And I think typically in more primitive societies, or even, well, I won't even say more primitive, but more communal societies where there was a lot of festivals and stuff like that, altered states of consciousness was quite a normal thing to happen. You know, if one thinks in those sort of primitive days, people dancing around the campfire, and that type of thing, sort of shamanic drumming, etc., those type of festivals, gatherings were quite commonplace in societies. And I think even towards the more modern era, festivals and big dances and stuff like that was very much part of small little towns, etc. And I think that provided some level of alteration of consciousness for people. And what a lot of people are saying is that in modern society, there is no, you know, all these type of things have fell away, and there is no real healthy ways for people to alter their consciousness. And as a consequence of that, people have been looking in that in drugs. I mean, drugs do a pretty good job at altering our consciousness. So what some of the guys are saying is that one of the etiological factors of addiction is the fact that we are hardwired for this altered state. Drugs gives you this thing immediately, and when your need for the alteration of consciousness isn't fulfilled, you're going to find that need fulfilled in a very profound way through drugs, because there's very few things that alter consciousness as profoundly as drugs do, certainly with that doesn't require any skill. So in that way, if one understands a lot of people's need for drugs as a seeking of altering of consciousness, one can then see that the aim or the impetus towards addiction isn't necessarily seen as a negative thing. It's actually an healthy urge.
Yes.
That it's just on the wrong way to actualize that urge. So it's that old saying of looking for love at sort of all the wrong places, you know. It's a healthy thing, but you're using a deleterious method to do that. And I think one also needs to make the difference between, you know, drugs and drug addiction. I mean, a lot of people find very healthy and successful ways of altering their consciousness through drugs and stop. You know, they can control that. But for us addicts, we take it, we clearly take it too far. And then that becomes a pathological state, actually an altered state. That's not just related to the drug, but actually the whole trance-like state and all those things related to addiction is actually all the state which I'm going to go into now. And then these other two guys called Milton and Sunderworth. Have you ever come across their work?
Repeat them again.
Two guys called Milkman and Sunderworth.
No, I don't know them.
Yeah, they wrote quite a thick book on basically the idea of alterations of consciousness, and how people seek out to alter their consciousness, that it's a very innate part of our being.
Yeah.
And what they propose is that there's, you know, throughout history, any person has got a dominant way of altering their consciousness. So any person will fall under one of the three categories, or might even fall under all three, or just two, or whatever. And it's basically three ways that we use to soothe psychic pain. which most of life, you know, most of life can be painful. So people from a very young age develop ways to soothe themselves. And they say that there's basically three styles, satiation, arousal, or fantasy. So it's basically numbing and arousing and fantasy. And these three methods of altering your consciousness is also related to three specific neuropathways that's designed for alteration of consciousness: the stimulant neuropathway, the depressant neuropathway, and then also the fantasy neuropathway. So when one looks at that from a context of addiction, is that, and also what they say is that there's basically three groups of drugs: the depressants, the stimulants, and the psychedelics. And obviously the depressants work with a depressing numbing neuropathway, stimulants with the arousal, and then the hallucinogens, especially with the fantasy pathway.
Yeah.
Is that from a young age, people actually learn one of these ways. So a kid from a young age will learn to numb himself through various activities, or they learn to stimulate themselves, or they will get lost in fantasy. And basically what happens is this sort of preferred coping style nearly sets the template for not necessarily for addiction in later life, but for the drug of choice. So somebody that has always used fantasy as a way to numb, you know, soothe psychic pain, as they call it, will obviously be very attracted to psychedelics or cannabis, which is also a psychedelic, etc. And somebody that you're stimulating will find methamphetamine and that type of stuff more attractive. So what's important for me is that understanding somebody's preferable coping style of altering his consciousness will make one understand why some people are attracted to certain drugs. But most importantly, that person will have that specific coping style once he cleans up as well. If somebody always used from a young age a numbing method to you know, deal with pain, then he's still going to use that method. So basically part of a therapist's job is a way to give people new ways to cope that is correlated to their coping style. You can't give somebody that's never used the stimulating coping style, you know, he needs to go bungee jumping and do all sorts of sports that are stimulating, because it's probably not going to work for him, because that's not his way of coping.
Guy, can I ask a question? Do you mind repeating? Sure. I looked up their book online as you're talking. It sounds really interesting to me. I'd like to see it.
Yeah.
Could you repeat the three styles? Numbing was one. Fantasy was another one?
The other one is arousal.
Arousal. I'll tell you what I'm wondering about. Just make a note, and I want you to continue, of course. I wonder if there'd be any kind of possible connection to Bowlby's attachment styles. All three of those, I wonder if they open into attachment styles. You know, you got the dismissive attachment style that would be more prone to numb. You have the insecure style that would be more prone to arousal. And you have the third style, ambivalent or whatever it's called, that might be, that's probably too simple of a correlation, but it does come to mind.
Absolutely. I think, and I'm going to get to that now.
Sorry.
I'm not familiar with his work, but just what you're saying there is correlating with some of the stuff, because I think there's a psychodynamic meaning or psychodynamic subtext to all of these things, which I'll touch upon now.
Please, thank you.
So that leads me, you know, that's just a very quick overview of states. But what I find really interesting is the typology that correlates with states of consciousness. So, you know, looking at, you know, it's not just as simple as saying people have a need to alter their consciousness. There's all sorts of different ways of altering consciousness and different methods, etc. So one needs to, in a way, bring a typology to states of consciousness to really understand that. And what those guys that I spoke about last time briefly, Ullman and Paul, that book Narcissus in Wonderland, Self-Psychology and the...
Yes.
I think it's called the Self-Psychology of Addiction and the Treatment Thereof, or something like that. They basically work with cohorts bipolar self typology, where Code proposed that the self is sort of conceptualized as an arc that links these two poles, the grandiose pole and the idealized pole in a way, and these two poles create some sense of balance or continuity for the self as you know, kids develop and grow and whatever. And these two poles are related to one's narcissistic needs at a young age, and I think especially from sort of 1 year to 4 years around that period, that's where these two poles really start forming. And that's where sort of personality disorders and stuff can creep in, is when there's a disturbance in the formation of these two poles. And obviously these poles are metaphors, it's not actual existing poles. But what I find really interesting about that, bringing a typology to that, is that what Coet also said is that if there's a disturbance in those specific poles, for instance, he said in the grandiose pole, the phenomenological experience of that disturbance will be stuff like depression, or it might even be hypomania, whatever. There's a specific felt experience when there's a disturbance, and in the idealized pole, or the pole of omnipotence, whatever you want to call it, can also have a type of manic experience and an anxious experience that correlates with that when that isn't satisfied. So very simply, the idealized pole very often correlates with a father. And, as a kid, you need to think your father's the coolest on the planet, he's the strongest, he can save you from every possible disaster, etc. And obviously, it's not real, but that fantasy creates a feeling of safety. So you feel, you know, it doesn't matter what happened, daddy's going to fucking sort it out, you know. And that creates a sense of safety. If you don't have that, there's going to be a feeling of anxiety, like the world is unsafe, you know, am I going to navigate all these complex things? And that is the phenomenological experience of the idealized pole, the narcissistic need for idealization not being fulfilled. Now, what's interesting about that as far as typologies goes is one can actually bring an integral theory. They use a masculine and a feminine typology quite a lot. Is one can actually bring a masculine and a feminine typology to these two poles of Coet, which he never really articulated, but if one looks at it from that lens, one can start seeing that it correlates with that. So the mirroring pole and the mirroring narcissistic needs that kids have can be seen as a sort of feminine typology, because that's normally derived from the mother. You know, you're a good boy, everything will be fine. So you can see that as a sort of feminine pole, the grandiosity pole / feminine pole. And then the idealized pole of the self can be seen as a more masculine type of pole, because that's normally related to the father. So bringing a typology of masculine and feminine, we can see that in our psyche there's these two parts that are slightly more masculine and slightly more feminine. Now what's interesting, as we just saw, is that we also saw that drugs of choice can also be classified as masculine or feminine. So obviously the depressants, which is the numbing sort of neural pathway, can be seen as a feminine type of pathway. And the excitatory pathway, the stimulating pathway, can be seen as a more masculine pathway. So basically, what I've sort of proposed in the past and other people have proposed is that one can also then understand addiction as a dysfunctional masculine or femininity in that way, that relates to one's sort of archaic needs for each of these satisfaction of these two poles. And you will seek out a masculine or a feminine drug that is going to rectify these object relations that can be classified as masculine or feminine. So each drug of choice, in a way, has got a masculine or a feminine voice. And what's interesting as well is these Uman and Paul guys have said that the underlying core of addiction is fantasy. So you're not really addicted to the drug. You're addicted to the fantasy that the drug gives you. And this fantasy is related to these unmet narcissistic needs. So if you didn't have an idealized fantasy met as a kid through your father, for instance, that you have a need for idealization. So when you take a drug, you take crack cocaine, you're going to activate this dormant, idealized fantasy of whatever that's going to mean to you. Therefore, crack cocaine is really going to be very appealing because it's meeting this very unmet need that's sort of lying dormant most of your life. An easy way to try and understand that, you know, because the bloody self-psychology and object relations theory has got such a lot of technical terminology. It's like doing archaeology before you can understand what these guys are saying. So I think an easier way to understand it is just seeing it from this masculine and feminine typologies. And I've noticed, for instance, with urine addicts, very often have distant fathers or absent fathers in their life. And while cocaine addicts, and they very often enmeshed with a mother, so there's a sort of over-enmeshment of the feminine and a lack of masculinity, whereas urine addicts very often have cocaine addicts very often have very domineering fathers and sort of distant mothers or absent mothers, or sometimes even borderline or narcissistic mothers. So there you can see, you know, the one type of person didn't have a certain need met is from a masculine feminine typology, and he's gonna seek that out in a sort of masculine or feminine type of drug or even behavior. And the interesting thing is that the two seem to correlate. If you have a feminine pathology, you're gonna seek out masculine drugs, and if you have a masculine pathology, you're gonna seek out feminine drugs. And I think the very real use for this in addiction treatment or understanding one's own addiction is that once you stop your main drug of choice, if you're addicted to crack due to your feminine pole, you know, being dysfunctional, putting it in simple ways, then that need is still going to remain once you enter treatment or once you're in recovery. So you might have stopped using a certain drug, but then you're going to be prone to cross-addicting in other types of behavior that provide the same stimulus to the same neuropathway. So for instance, if somebody was a crack addict and he was addicted to the, you know, his stimulating neuropathway was altered through drugs, then he's going to be very prone to get into stuff like pathological gambling, but not just any gambling, because gambling as well has got a masculine and feminine typology. In fact, once you start looking at it from a masculine and feminine topology, you see that all clusters of addictive drugs and behavior, and I know, Eddie, we've briefly spoken about that. I'm pointing upwards because you're my top left corner in my cyber realm, my screen. Maybe you're down there, but yeah, anyway. So even in pathological gambling, there's a masculine and a feminine typology. The masculine typology is the risk-taking gambling, which is stuff like roulette, maybe blackjack, the sort of high-risk, big stakes, you know, it's a big rush. And obviously a lot of those type of gamblers, the average roulette player is going to be more prone to cocaine than like Valium. You're not going to be dozed out in Valium while he's playing roulette. This is not going to work for that. So in pathological gambling, there's also stimulatory types of behavior. Whereas stuff like the slot machines have got a very sedatory, very numbing effect again. It's the opposite effect. If you look at the people sitting at slot machines, they're all like in a trance. But the guys at the tables are all excited. And then even in stuff like sex addiction, you start seeing the same typology. You know, the cons actually had this whole sort of sheet of 10 different types of nearly sex addictions that can exist, but all of those can be classified under masculine stimulating or and sort of anti-anxiety, so the dietary function, stuff like high risk prostitutes, picking up prostitutes are much more of a stimulatory behavior, where stuff like voyeurism or internet pornography, where it's very repetitive and trance-like, has got a more sedatory effect. And then even addiction and codependency, which very often is a dialectic between these two things. You have the addict and you have the codependent. There you can also see the one is has got a masculine voice and the one has got a feminine voice. Both of these can relate back to these two poles. So basically, in a nutshell, is that once you bring this masculine-feminine typology to all of these things, you can start, you know, it just sort of appears that, well, this one definitely seems more masculine, and this one seems more feminine. And I think where Ullman and Paul and those guys disagree with Wildman and Sunderworth is that Ullman and Paul would say is that there's only two addictive neuropathways. The fantasy pathway is active in both of them, where Sunderworth and those guys would say there's three neuropathways, you're either stimulating, either fantasy, or either numbing. The narcissist or Wonderland guys would say whether you're stimulating or you're numbing, fantasy is always being activated. And whatever the fantasy that's being activated relates back to those early narcissistic woundings. So I think the main real value of that, I think, apart from sort of using that typology to understand one's own issues, you know, I always say, and funny enough, treatment success depends on if you only had one of the poles damaged, then there's better chance of success. That then both poles are damaged. And poly addicts, guys that like cocaine and heroin, are very often people that had the masculine and feminine fucked up. So those are the people that I call, he's got a really well-balanced personality, he's got a chip on both shoulders. And I certainly was one of them, you know. So you had issues on both sides, so you're going to have a strong attraction to the high and a strong attraction to the low. And if you really want to have these archaic needs like met, you know, 100%, then you do get into stuff like speedballing, you know, heroin and cocaine mixed, or you mix your addictive patterns with an upper and a downer. So there's a packaged fantasy of the idealized, you feel all powerful, you feel omnipotent, but at the same time, you also feel warm and embraced by the drug. Which means, you know, both of these poles are being held. And from that point of view, one can see why that type of cocktail has become so addictive and so difficult to get off. And a lot of people that get into that level of poly drug use is very, very low success rate out of that, because it's speaking to such primal archetypal needs. It's not just the fact that you're high and you're numb that is so appealing. It's really going to your core, and it's satisfying your core in such a profound way, but mostly you're unaware of that. You just have a very strong pull towards that behavior. So I think what's very useful in addiction treatment is also the allocation of counselors. So if you see it as a typology, if you see a client whose issues are primarily towards the feminine, and you give him a counselor that leans primarily towards the feminine, it's actually going to have a negative effect. So for instance, a heroin addict doesn't need some codependent female counselor that's going to tell him how great he is and just hug him, you know, the whole time and give him unconditional positive regard. The heroin addict actually needs to kick up the ass as well. He needs healthy masculinity that's going to tell him, you know, get off the chair, get into the sea, do this, do that. And he's already enmeshed with the feminine. He's got too much feminine, you know. He needs to be detached from the feminine. And what adds another level of complexity to these things is that you could be a male with feminine issues, or female with feminine issues, or female with male issues, or female with female issues, and that's going to affect how you then relate to the opposite sex, and especially in a therapeutic way. So, for instance, males with urinates, there's also a thing of rites of passage, and I think that's where the sort of mythopoetic men's movement could bring in a lot of value to this type of stuff. And looking at the Jungian archetype of the mother complex, which in a way is an enmeshment with a mother, and where they speak about in Iron John, where the father needs to steal the key under the mother's pillow. And that's in a way what needs to happen with a male urinating, is there needs to be a man that needs to come into his life and steal the key from his pillow and say, listen, and you need to cut the umbilical cord now. You need to leave mother. Because that's the fantasy with a drug like heroin, is to stay enmeshed in this womb-like, encapsulated, where you completely mirrored all the time, this narcissistic need for, you know, just warmth and comfort. So from a therapist sponsor point of view, it's actually quite important that the person has the right type of sponsor or therapist. So a crack addict, I would give a crack addict a good old codependent female counselor, will do him the world of good, and a male addict, I'd give a nice narcissist male counselor, will do him the world of good, you know, kick his ass. And I think that's the type of thing that in treatment environments I very often overlook is matching up, you know, the right type of therapist with the right type of client, because we can't really understand what the client's needs are. And I think on the interpersonal way, the best measurement is really to use these sort of object relations type of concepts and self-psychology concepts, because when somebody enters treatment, you know, you're actually speaking to a three-year-old. You're not dealing with a 50-year adult. So you're dealing with a three-year-old, and you need to address that person at the level, at the needs that they need currently, which is basically the ego state of the three-year-old. So I don't know if that makes sense from the masculine, feminine stuff.
I like it, Guy. I have a question for you. Is that I wonder if there's a way that this could be, theoretically, it really holds, and I know based on your own experience working, do you have a sense of any way that this could be researched out with a larger population to see if it holds up?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if one develops, there's a fair amount of research out there of correlating drugs of choice with childhood issues. But it's not framed within a typology necessarily, and it's not framed within, it's certainly not framed within a masculine and a feminine typology. I think that why the masculine and the feminine typology is so useful is that I think that's one of the, you know, underlying sort of bipolarities in life and the dialectic between that. And I think in addiction, it's a very, very strong theme that runs through any type of addiction and the relationship an addict has with his addiction.
Mm.
I think if one had to do research and actually create a type of typology, a system of typology, and then do research on that typology and then say, well, you know, how many addicts with distant fathers are crack addicts? And how many addicts with distant mothers are crack addicts? How many with, you know, heroin? Do those type of addicts, you know, would a crack addict would he become addicted to roulette? Or would he become addicted to slot machines and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So I think once one starts seeing those correlations, you'll see, well, actually there is a pattern. Yeah. And that's why I say to dogs in treatment, if there's a heroin addict and there's a girl in treatment, you know that the heroin addict's going to fall in love. Doesn't matter what chick or eyes in treatment, you will fall in love with the first woman he meets. The crack addict is going to have sex with every chick he meets in treatment, but the heroin addict is going to find his soulmate with the first woman that walks through the door. And the reason I think for that is that basically what the heroin addict has been addicted to is that, firstly, that mirroring transference, the psychotropic effect of being in an altered state of mirroring, whether that's love or heroin or whatever the fuck, releases certain chemicals, and it's related to the oxytocin molecules and stuff like that. So there's a very specific psychoactive effect when an addict is in that state, and that stuff correlates very closely to the experience of being in love.
Yeah.
So the heroin addict, whether he knows it or not, when he gets a glimmer of like I'm falling in love, his brain unconsciously goes, well, fuck, this is the stuff that I'm really into. You know, I'm into the release of oxytocin. I dig this. So psychologically, he's gonna, you know, really merge with that experience.
Yeah.
And I mean, probably 80% of all the heroin addicts I've ever worked with in treatment, they always had some romantic thing, and it was never like I want to just have sex with her and have a party. It was always like I think I'm really in love with this woman. And that made me wonder, then if you look at it from these male-feminine typologies and ways of coping that predate a drug of choice, you can see, well, you know, being in love and being on heroin is a very similar phenomenological state, and the neurochemical state of the two states are very similar. You know, if you ever shot heroin, if you're in love, you wouldn't really know which is which. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the worst one is being in love on heroin, then you completely... So unconsciously, addicts seek out experiences that correlate with a certain psychoactive experience of the natural endogenous chemicals that are in their body. And the problem with that is that if that isn't acknowledged, they will always seek that out. You know, so you're an addict will continuously having doomed romantic relationships if he doesn't understand that there's also a pathological need underlying that.
Yeah.
And the crack addict or the meth addict is going to have doomed high risk behavior that's going to go on through his treatment for a long time.
Yeah.
And you know, codependency, all that stuff has got a dialect between the masculine and the feminine, and I think one sees that in recovery a lot. Somebody with 10 years clean develops another pattern that is equally destructive, and that pattern very often correlates, if one had to look at it from this point of view, with these underlying neuropathways and underlying object relations, etc., etc. These things are all correlated. It's clearly not not a chance.
I wanted to mention two things, if I might, Eddie and Hamlet, then I want you guys to pipe in here. First of all, Eddie, I want to agree. First of all, Eddie, I want to agree with you. I think this has huge practical implications, Guy, and I really hope that we, all of us together, can collaborate to write this up. Can you imagine how helpful this could be to people in rehabs, you know, sober living houses, any kind of treatment setting, to have these kinds of cartographies at their hand, you know, at their disposal, and just to share this as information? It would provide so much simplification of what happens a lot without any guidance. And so I really want to support you, Eddie. I feel really strong. This is really rich stuff, Guy. Way to go. I mean, it's really outstanding. So thank you. Secondly, Guy, I wanted to mention something and ask you guys all for your thoughts about this. When I started at Passages here in Malibu, you know, a dozen years ago, we had a psychiatrist on the staff there who would come in and do EEGs for brainwave, you know, study brainwave patterns or record brainwave patterns of every client coming in. And he would wait until a certain time. It had to do with the half-life of the substance, till they were free enough of the substance. And he would say, till they were back to their birthday brain, was his term. He was a very idiosyncratic gentleman. I'll leave him unnamed right now. He was odd and very interesting and really intelligent. But one of the things that he used to say, Guy, was that, and I think it's a parallel from a neurobiological end to what you're talking about phenomenologically and developmentally. He could look at somebody's EEG without looking at their chart to find out whether they were addicted to heroin or cocaine or you name it. He could look at their EEG patterns and he could look at the client and say, I bet you can't stand marijuana, but that you love ecstasy or whatever it would be. And he would be, clients would come to me and they'd go, that was crazy. In other words, he could look at their brainwave patterns and say, this is going to be what you like and this is going to be what you don't like. I wonder if you have any thought about that in light of what we're talking about in terms of typology, to include, not in a reductionistic way, but in a complementary way, the neurophysiology, let's say, along with various typologies, including even masculine, feminine.
Well, absolutely. I mean, each of these phenomenological states is going to have a correlated brainwave state. And I think that's one of the underexplored elements of biological, neurophysiology. I'm not that interested in the actual physiology of the brain. Yeah. I'm more interested in the state of the brain from a state perspective, because I think there's much more value in that. So that guy, I mean, I like doing a trick where I don't ask the guy what his drug of choice is, and I do a biopsychosocial, and I say to him, yeah, you're an addict, aren't you? And you don't like crack, hey? I bet you. And he's like, yeah. So
that's good.
That's the same way. He's seeing the same thing through upper right quadrant state, brain state perspective.
Yes.
Whether it's alpha, beta, and what areas of the brain is it, there's predominance of alpha, beta.
Yep.
And somebody can see it through assessment perspective, or through, what the issues were with these parents, so all of those states will have a correlation. The trick is to be able to articulate that correlation.
Thank you. Eddie, Hamlet.
Yeah, my mouth is open. This has been a fascinating lecture, Guy. I mean, have you guys decided how to access these recordings again? Because I would like to hear this whole lecture again.
Yeah, I would too.
A couple times, maybe.
Yeah. I'm recording it as we speak, for one thing. I wanted Guy to know that. And Guy, you were going to say something.
No, I was also going to say, we are recording the stuff, so we'll just edit it.
Yeah.
Just edit out all the stupid stuff that we also say in between. So we'll.
That would be my comments.
Yeah.
Hamlet, I promised you to get on this, and it was when everybody, you asked this a couple weeks ago, and everybody was in Hungary. Let me make a note, and I'll do it right now. I'll make a note to Heidi, because I think that Heidi and or Pam had talked about our creating a repository, and I'd like to get on that immediately. So I'm sorry that it's taking you reminding us the second time, but I'll get that ball rolling. We have them, and we just haven't organized them. And as Guy says, there probably needs to be some editing, because some of these things start early and end late and so on. I want to make it easier for you as a listener. I want to do what you're doing. I want to review these lectures. This lecture today is so chock full. I'd love to listen to it again and work the material again. Yeah, I appreciate the input.
Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah, Guy, you should definitely put this together in some sort of writing format, or I just listened to it several times.
Yeah.
I agree with everything you absolutely said, except I just, I'm trying to make a connection to my own personal life, and I've always liked hallucinogens and stimulants, but according to your lecture, that meant that I would have, I hate to reduce it to such simple levels, but that I would have an issue with my mother, let's say, or an absent mother. And it's actually quite the opposite. If I had to choose one, it would probably likely be like my dad wasn't around, even though my parents are still married, but he just, was a workaholic. He was never, ever there. Like I lost him at about 4 or 5 when we came over from Cuba. So it's hard. I guess these things don't really apply to everybody, and it's not that black and white.
No, it's definitely not that black and white. I think the only time it will become apparent is if you take like 1,000 people, then there'll be a majority that tends
to,
you know what I mean? So on an individual basis, you can't actually use it. But what, because also the mother and the father can also provide, I mean, you can get your mirroring needs from your father as well. It doesn't mean you just get it from your mother and you get one need from the father. just traditionally that specifically men tend to get their idolized needs. You know, men don't often idolize their mother. They more idolize their father. So there's a certain tendency, but obviously you're going to get your idolized need met through your mother as well. And mostly you get your mirroring, you're a good boy, and you get most of your cuddles from your mother. But obviously you can get that from your father as well. I mean, both should, you know, give both of the roles. But there is a certain tendency to get one a bit more from the one and one a bit more from the other.
Yeah, I have so many questions, but I rather listen to the lecture again. That was great.
But I think the real interesting thing for me in this whole thing, from an altered state of perspective, is what that Ullman and Paul guys have said, which I find totally fascinating, is that, and also understanding addiction, not just the drug high as an altered state. I think it's an ego state that you're addicted to. It's not about when you're using drugs or not. It's about once you go into addictive mindset, that itself becomes mind altering. So like when you decide to go and score crack, when you decide to go and use, I mean, you're already in an altered state. You know, the altered state doesn't just happen with the ingestion of the drug. The whole scheming, planning, you know, all of that is a trance-like state. You know, stuff like sex addiction, the pursuit of the score is much more altering than the actual sexual act.
For sure.
Everyone knows that. So the way that I'm starting to see it is not just seeing the ingestion of the drug as an altered state, but actually addiction can be classified as an altered state. That it's got its own values, its own way of the world and everything. And you see that in treatment, for those that have worked in treatment. You know, one day the guy's like, you know, he's normal, and then all of a sudden, he gets into his addict mode, and all of a sudden he's like a completely different human being. You know, you can't reason with the guy, he's full of shit, he's like in this altered state. And then 2 days later, he's sort of back into a normal state. Now, we see him as that because he's in recovery, he's not on drugs. But that altered state is his primary state in active addiction. So the recovery process isn't really about stopping the drugs. It's about getting the person out of this trance-like altered state that an addictive lifestyle affords him. And I think when people relapse, it's not because they want to go and use, it's that they sort of, for whatever reason, they regress back into this altered state, which is a closed-off state. And once you're in that altered state, your capacity to reason, your capacity to remember the past, your capacity to think about the future, all of these things is diminished, you know. So I think the altered state conception needs to be used in a much, much more broader sense. And I think that's why what Ullman and Paul say is that the underlying experience of addiction is this altered state of megalomania, an altered state of control. But that is the underlying state of addiction. So when addicts get into the state where they have this profound need for control and they think they're in control, then they start moving into this addictive type state. And once that addictive type state gets too far, the next step is actually the using of the drug. The using of the drug is just the last part of the altered state. It's not actually the real altered state. And I think once one starts seeing that, it becomes a different ballgame. You know, it's not just dealing with drugs or not. You're actually dealing with an altered state in a human being.
Yeah.
And what you're saying there, Andy, with the flow, that's another fascinating thing, is the altered state of drug addiction and the healthy altered state of flow, neurophysiologically, is virtually one and the same thing. Mm-hmm. That's what Patrick Barnes and these guys have said. So the good thing for addicts is if you fucked up your brain by being altered on drugs, you have a very similar, you have now the similar, same capacity to enter flow just using healthy methods than the normal people would do. So your chance of being a concert pianist is greater because you've taught your brain how to go into a flow state. You still have the neural pathways. Whether you go into it doing a concert pianist or whether you're doing it through smoking crack, that altered state, neurochemically and neurophysiologically, it's virtually identical. So I think that's the bonus. It's like, you know, people with bipolar disorder can find sort of transcendent experience easier, because they really, like, you know, that from the ego. They just need a slight push and they can go into, like, non-dual. So that might be the positive side of something like that. And the same with addicts is we've developed an innate capacity to enter flow, which most people can't really do or have to try very hard. So I think that's the positive side of addiction. One of the positive consequences of addiction, one of the few.
Guy, I'm going to have to go in just a second, but I want to just append a little asterisk. Your last comments here really tie in with the Luigi Zoha book that we're reading on ritual and initiation. I'd love to bring that material in almost as a postscript in a future conversation where we could talk about the salutary or positive things that are associated with addiction, including what you just said about access to what Jungians would call the unconscious and what Csikszentmihalyi would call the flow state, but that all of us in this meeting know what you're talking about. It'd be wonderful to write a piece on that, kind of in the spirit of the book we're reading together, so, or that I'm reading now. So just append that for a future conversation. I got to run, you guys. It's great to see you in person, Eddie. Your face, it's great. And Hamlet, wishing you well, and we'll be in touch. I'll see you guys on Thursday. And Guy, I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks a million, Guy. This was superlative. Really wonderful presentation. Really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you.